And on one occasion, we read in Acts, he stayed there for 18 months. He was a bit of a pioneer. He was the first person to be involved with the church there. He worked hard, and we know that he convinced many of these wise Corinthian folk to become Christians. There's one verse in Acts chapter 18 there, which just tells us a bit about that. It said that Crispus, the synagogue ruler, and his entire household believed, and many Corinthians believed and were baptized. So at that point, the church was growing numerically. It was certainly growing as a result of Paul and other people becoming involved. But the one thing we also know is that everything wasn't well. All was not well in that church. There was quarrels, there was jealousy, there were some morality issues, and Paul, from a distance, had to decide how to address these. And he did so by writing the young Christians at that church a letter. Now, I'd just like to look a little bit at some of the historical events leading up to this, which have been backed up by historians throughout the ages. I think one thing that gets me sometimes, I was watching, I think it was Stephen Fry a few months ago being interviewed, and Stephen Fry was saying that, clearly these are all stories I'm acting out. He was taking part in a biblical play. They are just stories. Well, undoubtedly, this book, the Bible, contains a lot of stories. Jesus himself spoke in stories. But a lot of what we read is very, very firmly backed up by historians of faith and sometimes not of faith. So I'd just like to look at some of the folk. And if Laura wants to pop up that neck picture of a gentleman, I don't know. I was going to say, do you know who that is? But I think there's a clue there, isn't there? The Roman Emperor Claude. Aren't they scary eyes? I couldn't find a picture other than just an old statue of Claudius. So let's enter into this story of this first Corinthian church, the most powerful man in the world at that time. Claudius reigned from about 41 to 54 AD. He was the only Roman emperor, just as a point of aside, who was born outside of Italy. He was born in modern-day Lyon in France. It took him a while to actually succeed to the emperor's throne because at that point he actually suffered from lameness and illness. So he took power a little bit later on in his life, but when he did, he was a highly effective Roman emperor. He was an extremely good administrator. Some of the things that we know through history that Claudius was actually responsible for was great infrastructure projects, roads, bridges, canals, which become famous. There's a picture there of the Pont du Gard, I think, in France. Andy Craig and I visited there last year. That was actually built, taking a lot of slave labour to do it, during Claudius's reign, at about AD 48, AD 50. It's an incredible structure. It has canals on the top. It takes water from several miles in the hills across the top of that viaduct down to the town of Nîmes in southern France. And it is still there today. We also know that during Claudius's reign, he did a lot to consolidate the empire. I smiled when I read that he'd actually sent, I think it was four legions, up to about 6,000 soldiers each, to Britannia to sort out these unruly Brits. There was a lot of opposition to Roman rule over here. We had factions like Celts, you know, these folk from Wales and Scotland who weren't having it. So they had to sort them out, and he sent a lot of soldiers over to do that. So he was a very, very effective Roman emperor. But also, I think, which is perhaps more relevant to our story, Claudius clamped down hard on many religions. He favoured an ancient form of the state religion, and that would have been to ingratiate himself with his own people, with druids particularly, mystics, astrologers. He wasn't really having any of that, and he did suppress many of the religions at that time. He was a real political survivor and also had many enemies. Now, how is this relevant to church growth at Corinth? Well, in that first passage that you read to us there, it said Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome. Historians like Josephus tell us that this happened at about AD 49. He expelled the Jews from Rome due to their opposition to Roman rule. What he did, he just wanted to dilute their influence, so they scattered throughout the empire. Anti-Semitism was alive and kicking in the first century. Claudius wanted to get the Jews and these troublesome people out of his way. But one of the side effects of that, we know, was that we had this couple, a young couple called Aquila and Priscilla, and they fled to Corinth. Now, this is against a backdrop of, in that period, I think it was only about 20 years later, the Jews made an all-out assault on Jerusalem. They actually destroyed Jerusalem and the temple around about AD 70. And we know from that historical documents written by Josephus that about 1 million people were slaughtered there. But this couple, Aquila and Priscilla, we read, they fled to Corinth, which was also under Roman rule at that time. They were tent makers, like Paul, so they had a common affinity with him, and they became key partners in the ministry there. I just put a few verses up, a few references that we have to this couple, Aquila and Priscilla, if I pop them up there. Read from Rooks. Paul said, "Greet Aquila and Priscilla, my fellow workers in Christ. They risked their lives for me. All of the churches should be grateful to me." They really put the neck on the line for this new church at Corinth. "Aquila and Priscilla salute you much in the Lord with the church that is in their house." They obviously ran a house church in Corinth at that time. "Apollos spoke boldly in the synagogue." This was this other leader that we hear about. "Apollos spoke boldly in the synagogue. When Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they invited him to their home and explained to him the way of God more accurately." So it's Aquila and Priscilla who were involved in this early church. They were teachers. They were early theologians. They'd actually taught this man, Apollos, much of what he knew. It's amazing, really, how God uses unlikely people to fulfill his purposes. We have a Roman emperor whose actions had unintended consequences of scattering people so that they then began to spread the gospel. And then you had two political refugees, Priscilla and Aquila, who actually went to Corinth and became key figures in the church there. Well, last week you probably heard from Simon just a little bit about how God's wisdom is contrasted to man's wisdom, sorry, is contrasted to God's ultimate wisdom. And we heard a little also too of just how the Spirit of God had helped some of these young Christians to understand some of the deep truths. But what did Paul say? What was his advice here to the church? Well, initially, we read that he reached out to his flock. Paul was a consummate pastor. He was gentle with them. But then he called them children, mere infants in the faith. Now, I think that's probably to a wise society like the Greeks in Corinth. Might have been a little bit insulting calling them children, mightn't it? But no, I think it would have been more insulting if he'd said, "You're like a pack of wolves or animals. You've been squabbling and arguing." But he didn't. He reached out to them and he called them children. They were new converts. They were new to the faith, and Paul realized that. They'd understood the basic principles of Christianity, but they had to grow, and they had to grow in grace and knowledge. But I think that this letter must have been a very hard one for Paul to write to this such a church where people were proud of their own wisdom and knowledge. But I think, to coin a modern phrase, a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. And the Corinthians at this point had a little knowledge, and they perhaps hadn't developed their faith any further. We know already they'd already received the Spirit of God. We'd heard about this in the previous chapter. They'd received the Spirit of God, but their behaviour didn't quite reflect it at this point, and that was just stunting their growth as Christians. Now, it was a great children's talk that John gave there, and John tailored that, obviously, to his audience, didn't he? I think if John had said, "Children, I'd like you to explain the deep doctrines of the Trinity," it might have just drawn a few blank stares. And that would have been from the adults. Children would have been okay with it. But he didn't. John didn't do that. John tailored it. And Paul tailors his advice to these young Christians, knowing what they need. Remember, he had spent time with them earlier on. But he was saying to them, you know, even as infants in the faith, children must grow. It's time, really, to move on. You've got the basics. You've got a good understanding there. But you must be guided by this Spirit that you've received. And we've got to remember at this point that he had spent 18 months with these people. So he would have known some of them pretty well. And I guess he was, what you could say, a very frustrated pastor. He spent these 18 months with them. He taught them these truths, but yet he was hearing now that they were quarrelling, squabbling, and it failed to grow as they should. But yet we see, just through the tone of this letter, that he remained patient and gracious with them. Well, should we really expect things to be too much different today? I know that Simon mentioned last week that this letter has been used throughout the centuries, and it's been a template used by churches as just to how churches can grow and how we can advise on difficult matters. I think, you know, if we've got to say that squabbling, jealousies, petty disagreements don't happen, some major scandals have taken place in the church that we all see. If you don't believe, you look at the lurid headlines that we see. I was chatting to an Irishman when I was having a bite to eat a couple of months ago in a bar in Ireland when I was over there for work. And this guy about my age, and he was telling me that, you know, people of his generation have turned away from the church. They've turned away from the established church there, particularly because some of the scandals there. And he said, furthermore, he said, I'm talking to my sons who were nearly 20 and almost encouraging them not to make up their own mind, although he did, but to be even more secular because some of the issues. Sometimes when some of these issues that Paul is mentioning here in their infancy spiral out of control, they can have devastating consequences. And I think in the nicest possible way, Paul is saying to these people, I mean, I used to smile when I heard the phrase, somebody is so spiritually minded that they're of no earthly good. I think in the nicest possible way, Paul is saying here, you're actually so earthly minded, you're thinking like you used to do before you were Christians, that you're very little spiritually good at the moment. But we know that one of the issues was a bit of the cult of the leader had broken out, hadn't it? You see, some of you are following me, some are saying you're following Apollos, some Kephas or Peter, some other influential people have been at that church at some point, Silas and Timothy. These were spiritual giants, so it was natural, really, for these young Christian folk to identify themselves with some. But it's going a little bit beyond that. And this was just, again, in Paul's eyes, further evidence that they were being directed by their old human standards rather than the newfound freedom that they had in Christianity. It may be important to say that in that era, it was common to deify humans who were seen to do special things. There was another occasion when the people in Lystra wanted to make Paul and Barnabas gods when they healed a man. They were calling them Zeus and Hermes and offering to sacrifice bulls to them. So that's kind of the backdrop. People would try to deify, so maybe it was a little bit more than just saying, I'm following Paul or Apollos. Maybe they were putting them on a pedestal, which was going to be unhelpful. Indeed, Claudius himself, the emperor, people wanted to deify him at some point. But just, he was a wily political operator, and he said, you know, I think it's up to the gods to appoint gods. He wanted to distance himself from religion. And I remember even in our own political spectrum, maybe a decade or so ago, didn't we? I think it was Alistair Campbell had said, we don't do God. He just wanted to distance himself from anything which would have been controversial. But Paul here made it very clear that he and Apollos, these leaders of the church, were only workers. They were mere servants. They'd helped these young folk to the faith, these young Christians, but it was actually God who was doing the work, and they mustn't be put on a pedestal. And I like the gardening illustration that John gave, and Paul in this passage uses a gardening metaphor, doesn't he? He said, I planted the seed. He was the pioneer. He'd actually gone there to preach where nobody had preached the gospel before. He was a pioneer. But Apollos watered it. So Apollos then stayed at the church and taught some of these young Christians the spiritual truths. And that had certainly made them grow. They'd experienced this transformational work of Jesus in their lives, and they were beginning to grow. It was a simple yet a profound truth that they were nothing without God. Paul was saying, we are nothing. We aren't anything special. We are just ministers. We are spreading the gospel of Jesus. But, you know, we aren't its founder. God made it grow. It was his field, in effect, that they were working in. A real lesson in humility for any teacher. And a one which we read throughout the New Testament is very central to Jesus' teaching. Many of the disciples have said to Jesus, "Who is the greatest? Can we sit with you at your right or your left side in heaven?" But Jesus had made it very clear that first of all, you must serve. Then Paul went on to use a building metaphor, in effect, didn't he? And he was trying to say that just as gardens need a gardener to grow, buildings need a builder to grow. Everybody had their part to play if the church was going to grow. And I like that phrase when Paul said, "I am an expert builder or a master builder." It sounds a bit boastful, that, doesn't it? You know, if somebody stands up, "I'm an expert, I'm a master builder." But I think we've got to remember Paul did have a very special role in the church. He had experienced the risen Jesus himself appearing to him on the Damascus Road, and he was a real builder of the early church there. But he was saying, other people, yourselves, to the church, and I guess that's included Christians throughout the centuries and ourselves here at Alma this morning, are building on that foundation, and that is how the church has grown. This city itself has a lot of history of a few what I call master builders, and George Muller, who was involved with the Muller Homes and this church here, I guess we put him in that category. He played a very special role. Wesley's Chapel is down in Broadmead there. John and Charles Wesley, I guess I would say they're master builders, and we could probably think of a few more modern day examples. But these builders needed labourers. The church needs to be built if it's going to grow. But Paul was just saying to the Corinthians, it can only be built on the foundation that has already been laid. And I quite like these building metaphors, and it's interesting even in the city here, there are churches, aren't they, called Cornerstone and Christ the Rock, and you can see where some of these pictures come, because they're just highlighting that Jesus is immovable. He's been a constant throughout history. He hasn't changed. And that what the Corinthians were learning 2,000 years ago, we can actually benefit from and learn today. There are parallels, I thought, when I was reading this with the parable that Jesus gave in Matthew 7 about the wise men building his house upon the rock and the foolish man who built his house on the sand. Well, I'm not going to mention that because actually John spoke about that here at Alma about a year ago. So if you want to hear that, you can look in the Alma Back Library and hear a super talk on that. But even then, Jesus had built his church, he urged his followers to build spiritual lives, to actually build their lives upon things of lasting value. And we heard even from the children who taught us all something there this morning, didn't we? That through prayer, teaching, Bible study, meeting together, those are the things that are going to make us grow as Christians. Now, I think just as we start to draw to a close, it was interesting that in verse 10, there was this phrase, wasn't there? And Paul gave a bit of a warning, I think. He said, yes, you've all got to be builders, you've all got to be gardeners, you've all got to do your bit, but each must be careful how he builds. He's giving just a gentle warning to the church there, because it is actually possible to build upon our Christian life, whether it's as a church or individually, things which aren't perhaps particularly edifying and can have little lasting value. I think it was the other week, Jean and I, after we left church here, we took a walk just down into to Broadmead from here. It was a beautiful sunny day. And we passed no less than three sets of Jehovah's Witnesses who actually had their trolleys and they were handing out their literature there. And indeed, we actually have a friend who is a Jehovah's Witness, and you know, certainly her commitment and her commitment to the witness bit is commendable. But we know that throughout the past maybe 100 or 2 years, they've actually built doctrine apart, which is man-made. They've had man-made doctrine, which has been added and added and added. And this is the kind of thing that Paul is just saying. You've got to seek the correct doctrine, seek to actually build upon the foundation that Jesus had actually laid. A bit later in that passage, it goes on to describe this as, you know, building your lives with gold, precious stones, and not things of wood and straw, because they won't last. This church, who'd had a few issues, was by no means dead. It still had real potential to grow, and Paul realized this, but he just wanted to encourage them to continue to seek to actually improve their relationships together, to improve their teaching, their doctrine, and their living, and maybe to put to one side the things which weren't helpful. Now, I think maybe it's all right listening to the advice, but in the real world, sometimes things happen differently, don't they? And I thought it was maybe important to mention that there will be times in each of our lives when, you know, both our spiritual and our physical foundations may be shaken a bit, when our own growth, personally and as a church, may falter. That's the nature of life, and that does happen at times. On a personal level, it could be if we lost a job, or maybe illness, relationship issues, bereavement, so on. And it's at these times that maybe our faith can be tested to its limits as we try to look to Jesus, to the risen Christ, for strength and seek how we can grow day to day. This growth isn't always, you know, a soaring upward trajectory. And I think we all have seen that. There are times in our lives when, you know, we've experienced helpful and healthy spiritual growth, and other times where perhaps we've just felt a little bit barren, a little bit static. This may have been for weeks, months, or even years in some cases. But Paul is just saying here that by the grace of God, if we just continually seek, we can still grow and do so. So in conclusion, I just wanted to ask just one or two questions here. I could have probably listed 20, but I think maybe let's keep it simple. I have just two or three. And the first one I'd like to ask is, do we at Alma, both individually and corporately, have a real desire to continue growing spiritually and as a church here? I'm sure I know the answer, but it's a good question to ask ourselves from time to time. Is there anything that we can do in our personal life? And I sometimes do this in our personal lives, where maybe it's our devotional time, maybe it's how we spend some of our spare time. Not that, you know, some time of relaxation and rest isn't good, because of course it is. But is there anything we can do just to improve our own spiritual growth? Then maybe just to think, it could be that, is our faith faltering a little bit spiritually? Are we faltering? Or has it perhaps become a little static? And if that is you or me, that's something which we can again just bring to God in prayer. Or it may be, because I don't know everybody here, that may might want to actually consider taking the first steps to looking at faith. And that again is something which anybody here, that is the purpose and mission of the church, just to bring new people in rather than to continually preach to the converted. We are working in God's garden and in God's building, and we must wholeheartedly rely on God to continually transform us. And what our prayer is, that we will be these spiritual beings that Paul talked about. And to do that, we know that we aren't alone, because of course we can have the help of the Holy Spirit himself, who can guide us in all that we do. In a few moments we'll be celebrating communion, and then we'll be just remembering, as we did at Easter just a few weeks ago, how through Jesus' own death and resurrection, we are united with the living God. And that's an amazing thing which we should never take lightly.